welcome everyone. Let us be silent while Jamie plays the prelude for us, which will be a prelude in G major by Mendelssohn. Tena koto te whanau o Unitarians o Tamaki Makaurau. Tena koto nā manuhiri. Nō mai haere mai me ki tēne whare karakia o Atua. Ko Ted Zorn Tokoingwa, ko Charleston, South Carolina, USA, aho. Ko Cooper River te awa. Ke Tamaki Makaurau, aho I noho ana. Nō reira e rōrangatira mā. Tena koto, tena koto. Welcome all, church whānau and visitors, to this place of worship, virtual and physical, a space made sacred by our coming together today and by Auckland Unitarians coming together here for 122 years. Welcome to those joining us remotely, to those here in the building, and to those watching the recording at a later time. If you are a visitor here for the first time, welcome, and thank you for choosing to be here with us. If you are a member or regular attendee, thank you for returning to join together in our free and responsible search for truth and meaning. For those here in person, all are invited to join us for a cup of tea or coffee immediately afterwards, following our service. It is our sacrament of hospitality. Consider this time together a sanctuary for the soul, a haven of peace and hope. It's a time to reflect on what it means to be human, what it means to be connected to our fellow humans, and how we spend our time and energy here on this earth. My name is Ted Zorn, and I'll be leading the service today. Our guest speaker, whom I will be introducing later in the service, is Paul Watson. Paul's talk and the theme of this service is entitled A New Way of Being, Men Being Real. My opening words are by Sharon Wiley. We speak so often of brokenness in religious life. Let us speak today of wholeness. You are welcome here, all of you. Every part of you beautiful, just the way you are. Here you do not need to be something more or something less. No holding back, no hiding. No exerting yourself, no trying to do more or be more. You have inherent worth and dignity, and nothing to prove here. Nothing to prove to me or the person sitting next to you or to the children or to anyone. You don't have to try to be witty or more quiet or more outgoing. You are beautiful. Every part of you is beautiful just the way you are. You do not need to change anything about yourself to be welcome here. Your skin, your hair, your belly, your limbs, your face, all beautiful just the way they are. You are extraordinary. Each and every one of you different from each, and beautiful in your own beautiful way. Breathtaking. Let us worship together. It is now time for the lighting of the chalice. I'll ask Chris Coles to come forward and light the chalice for us, please. We light this chalice to illuminate our way on our path towards a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, to bring warmth to the connections we embrace with each other, with all of humanity, and with the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, and to bring the heat of the flame to our commitment to justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. There's not a lot of heat right now.
You'll get the... Oh.
Can you see that?
It's lit.
It's lit. Just me.
Thanks, Chris. If you wish, I invite you to recite with me the covenant of our congregation, which Kate will put onto the screen for us. There. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest for truth is the sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve humankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with each other, and with our God. Now, Jamie will play some special music for us, and it is Carillon de Windmansteer by Louis Bien. Thank you. For this morning's reading, I've chosen a poem by Christopher Wallace called Authenticity. Just be real, friend. Be who you are. And where you are, that's enough. And it's the only way forward. Most of us have put on enough masks in our lifetime to have completely forgotten our original face. We've become far too clad with the heavy coats of expectation, suffocating under the weight of the ways we think we ought to be. You can drop that garb. There's always mystery at the core of who you are, and that's just fine. It's not that we must rediscover some definable self and hand that image over for validation. Rather, those solid definitions we cart around with us are heavy enough as it is, but we've continued pushing them despite the distress. We've gotten so used to that awkward play of needing to be a somebody as if that somebody were other than who we already are. We've forgotten how to let go with all the spontaneity of a flower's growth. Forgotten the beauty of our own personal bloom, that we are a fluid sweep of light and dark, that our faces, like the moons, wax and wane. You don't have to be any which way, other than the way you are. That sort of self-acceptance is the innate flourish, is the fluid cycle, is the way back into life. Don't fool yourself into believing there is a better disguise. Strip down to the bare beauty of your authentic state in this movement, in this moment, and move from there. So I'd now like to introduce our speaker for today, who's my friend Paul Watson. I first met Paul when I decided, on the recommendation of several of the men in here, several of the men in our congregation, to participate in a weekend experiential workshop put on by an organization called Essentially Men, which you've already heard Craig mention this morning. And some of you know well, and some of you heard me talk briefly about it 2 weeks ago in my talk. Paul was one of the facilitators for that weekend that I participated in. And over the last 2 years, I've gotten to know him much better and really learned to love and respect him. And I've also learned to learn from him, which I hope and am sure that you will today. Paul also happens to be the chair of the Board of Trustees for Essentially Men. And as an aside, Chris, he has a wonderful singing voice, so you might want to put your recruiting hat on after the service. For you, Paul.
Morena, correct, kia ora, everyone. And a heartfelt thanks to Ted for that beautiful introduction. When I first met you, Ted, around 20 months ago, I instantly liked you. And I think one of the reasons is that because, as you presented last week or 2 weeks ago, you've always had a thing for language. I think our brains connected quite quickly. My Auckland spelling, speaking, and debating days came flooding back as an articulate American shared his recent struggles, learnings, and pain with me. In the past 20 months, however, our hearts have also connected, and I'm now proud to call you my friend, brother, and a mentor for me in life. It's certainly an honour to be invited here by you today, and I hope that I can do your invitation justice. I certainly see you as a father figure to me, and as such, I seek your validation. Validation was what I was often looking for from my father as a young boy. And I've recently realised that what I experienced sometimes fell short of my expectations. In your introduction, Ted, you mentioned that you've learned to grow, learn, love and respect me, which are amazing things to hear from another person. The young boy inside me who seeks understanding, love and connection feels warm when I hear those things, even if my critical adult male brain finds them hard to let them infiltrate my persona. Over time, I've built up some strong barriers and armoury into my warm heart, including my overdeveloped thick skin, alongside my self-deprecating nature, and an internal negative rhetoric. The journey I'd like to take you on with me today is how essentially men's helped me in various parts of my life, including the polarities between Paul Watson as a man in 2023, standing here before you today, and Paul Watson as a man in 2012 as a 28-year-old. I'm not going to stand here and spout off everything that essentially men could do for you or for a man that you know, but rather share with you some of the battles in my life and how essentially men has helped me with them over the past 11 years, allowing you to make up your own minds as to how I might be able to help you or a loved one. Investigating my inner boy. I was lucky enough to have a wonderful mother. If someone asked me to describe her in one word, I'd use the word glorious. If pushed, I might stretch to perfect. She raised me by herself for the first couple of years after a short relationship with my biological father, but then fell in love with my dad at a parent-teacher interview, and our blended family began when I was 3. I inherited 2 older stepsisters and a brand spanking new dad. Because mum was my safety net, I 100% became a mummy's boy. Dad was at times a scary proposition for me as a boy in my early teens, and he was overly dominating at times, and we struggled to build a connection. I always thought that he favoured his girls, and he always thought that mum favoured me. Both assessments are probably true, but partly inflamed by their own projections. I became initiated to the world of sport through my uncle and grandfather, much more than my dad. I discovered cricket, soccer, rugby league at a young age, which weren't really dad's jam. We'd go hiking and camping because dad was a park ranger, but that wasn't really my happy place. And as a result, we struggled to connect and form a relationship that looked after and nurtured my little boy. All the nurturing came from mum. I'd snuggle in their bed with her, and I was always first, and always go to her first if I needed something. I have memories of wrestling and boxing with Dad, but never getting hugs or affection from him. I was bullied and a bully myself through my early teens, not surprising considering that home wasn't always that great, and the relationship with Dad was a bit strained. I really lost my way and was searching for brotherhood, camaraderie, and fun through the wrong channels, although sport often kept me in line. Westlake Boys was a real saviour for me. Their strong discipline, sports excellence, and competitive undertones really called to my brash and arrogant being. They helped to get me on the straight and narrow, and things started turning around at school and at home. But it wasn't me who turned things around with my dad. Just a year after strongly suggesting that I start flatting at the age of 18 because he wanted the nest empty, my dad invited me away camping with a bunch of men up in Whanganui. He'd recently completed the Essentially Men weekend and was heading up to a social gathering and wanted me to come along before the gathering started to help with the setup and see bits of his newfound world. I was way outside of my comfort zone. There were men hugging everywhere, and everyone talked differently to what I was ever used to. Dad had softened though. Anger, rage, abuse of his power that spilled out from time to time beforehand suddenly stopped. He had more time for me and was interested in how university was going and hearing about my girlfriends. He started hugging me and we hung out more often, 10-pin bowling, mini golf, and the occasional sports game. Over time, I started giving him more too, and our relationship deepened and became a positive one. It was just last week I had an epiphany. On the last Essentially Men weekend, someone paid me a nice compliment which I really took on board and felt really deeply. I realised that this man had briefly taken on the role of my father in my eyes, and the reason it felt so good was because it was an affirmation and words that I had always yearned to hear from my dad as a boy but never got. The boy in me had been underfathered and liked it when part of him was affirmed. I've realised more and more in recent years that in a lot of ways I'm still a boy at heart. I've worked in a job that encourages that all my life. I like to play as much as I can, and those of you that know me know that I love a joke or two. The beauty of me being aware of this is that I can sometimes check myself and assess whether I'm being a boy or a man in a certain situation, particularly with my wife. I have a newly found self-awareness around how much of a boy I can be, which never existed before the Essentially Men weekend. Making mates. All my friends growing up were through sport, debating, or drama. In all of these activities, I was the same guy. Loud, opinionated, boisterous, arrogant. I was often self-deprecating and always, always tried to be the funniest guy in the room. I always wanted to have a seat at the table, and I liked to be the leader or the 2IC to a powerful leader. I cared what others thought. I wanted to be liked by everyone. I had no concept of the idea that I was a polarizing figure. Some people loved me and some didn't. What I never comprehended, though, was that I was wearing a mask to protect myself from being outed. In my mind, if they thought I was funny, they would accept me. If they agreed with what I said, they would accept me. If I played hard and we won the game, they would accept me. I always had to be something within those environments. I was always pushing and striving for excellence, acceptance, and validation. Now that I think about it, I was also just yearning for the acceptance and validation that I so desperately yearned for my father. On the inside, though, I was a scared little boy who was frightened of not being good enough. If I was teased or put down, very quickly I turned into a victim and either ran away upset or went home crying to mummy, literally. I wasn't comfortable in my own skin and was battling inner demons. My weight was a real issue for me, partly because mum would always talk to me about it, so I knew it must have been a big deal. I was very sensitive about being teased and inwardly believed that I wasn't what a man should be, largely because I was overweight. Invariably, at all boys' schools come the penis jokes, and I had played rugby with some of these guys, so very quickly a harmless joke which was shared amongst everyone became a reality in my mind. It's hard to attract a member of the opposite sex when your self-rhetoric is that you're overweight, unsexy, and have a small penis. I learned that the hard way. Through Essentially Men, I journeyed with some men who I weren't used to. I was 28 when I did the weekend, meaning every single other man was older than me. I was the young buck. However, suddenly, through doing nothing differently other than being me, I was good enough in their eyes. And as it turns out, because I was good enough in their eyes, I became good enough in my own eyes. It's amazing how I believed other people's opinions with much more convictions than my own. After the weekend, we formed a men's group, a place where we would meet fortnightly and talk about things that were real for us. We wouldn't talk about weather, sport, politics, or work, just what was really going on for us. I shared with these men things that I've never shared with my parents or even the best couple of my mates. I didn't have to wear a mask. They already knew who the real Paul Watson was after sharing the Essentially Men weekend with him. And all of him was welcome at these fortnightly get-togethers. Walking with women. I'd had a sheltered upbringing, with sport and academia keeping me busy up until Form 5 or Year 11. It was the following year when girls came on the scene. The combined drama with Westlake Girls and Pack and Save Albany were the two lightning rods for me. I remember that I was internally terrified of the opposite sex, especially when they appeared interested in me. My assumption was that they'd only want to be friends with me because of my physical appearance and negative internal self-rhetoric. But the ones I appeared to attract were strong women who would give as good as they got when it came to opinions and banter. Shrinking violets didn't interest me either. I was always attracted to women who had a fire in their belly and a gorgeous smile on their face. I had a few girlfriends from the ages of 16 to 21, some breaking my heart after 13 days, others after a year and a half. It was always them doing the breaking up though. I've never broken up with anyone to this day. Of course, as well as ending the relationship, the self-doubt, wondering, and internal bullying which followed was always really intense for me. It wasn't so much of a what's wrong with me, moreover a why don't they like me as much as I like them. It was always felt like I fell harder than they did. Since doing the Essentially Men weekend, I've discovered that the relationships with women prior to the weekend was messy and unclean. What I was wanting from a girlfriend was to love me as much as my mum did. And that's a tough ask for a girl who's only out for a good time and only really signed up for that with the loud, funny, smart class clown. After doing the Essentially Men weekend, my self-confidence changed and I felt good enough. I became attracted to the opposite sex again, and after a long dry spell, I was fortunate to meet my wife Chrissy around a year after doing the weekend, shortly after a tough breakup for me. I was way more comfortable in my own skin, and I was able to meet a woman in relationship rather than expecting something from them all the time. We have a workshop at Essentially Men Events called Living with the Lioness, which helps men find ways of better engaging with strong and powerful women in relationship. My wife is certainly a lioness. It's one of the things I love the most about her. Whether it's protecting her cubs or showing her opinions and disapproval with her roar, it can often be heard and needs to be respected. It was only 2 years ago when a man I highly respect in the Essentially Men organisation said to me, "You don't really have any issues with your mum, eh?" And I said, "Nah, she's pretty much perfect." And he said, "Well, that's a lot of pressure on Chrissy then." And I didn't really understand what he meant, but then very quickly I did. With my mother on such a high pedestal for me, I have very high expectations of any woman that I'm in a relationship with. My mum has set an incredibly high, invisible ceiling, one which is almost impossible for any woman to reach. I'm very glad that I found Chrissy, who can smash through that ceiling in my eyes. Acknowledging addictions. I can stand before you today and can admit that I have a gambling addiction. It's deep-seated, I've been gambling since I was 17, and it's been part of everyday life for me. Some people have the need to be loved, some have the need to be in control. Mine is to be right. Trace it back to the debating days and trying to make my points count. In my spelling competitions, I either got the word right or I didn't. Deeper than that, I thought that if I knew things and was correct and knowledgeable, then people would like me. Gambling fulfilled an itch that I wanted to scratch. I could be right, make money, and watch sport all at the same time. Three great things, how easy is that? Throughout my 20s, my gambling addiction and problems started to manifest, and I lost sight of how much I was actually gambling. Because I bet big and normally won, I wasn't paying attention to the fact that I was spending thousands of dollars at a time, multiple times a day. All I was paying attention to was how much I would invariably win when I was inevitably right and my team won. There have been some dark, dark days. Days which have overshadowed key events in my life, and days which have no doubt taken years off my life. The associated physical and mental stress of watching to see if my big bet would squeak home or lose is a feeling which is hard to describe. As is the black hole when I'd lost a lot of money in the space of minutes. I'd feel very alone and very stupid. Two things that I really don't like feeling. The biggest learning for me through Essentially Men is that addictions are normal, particularly for men. Work, drugs, alcohol, sex, pornography, love, gambling, and food addictions are demons for a lot of men who I have encountered. In my experience, addictions often hide and fester away in the darkness, manifesting themselves in different ways, both overtly and internally. As Ted mentioned to you a couple of weeks ago, naming something can take away some of its power. I have certainly found that in naming my struggle, it has helped dissipate some of the hold that gambling has over me. In hearing other men's struggles with addictions over the years, it's also made me feel some gratitude that I only have two addictions. Looking at me today, you might be able to guess what my second one is. And a lot of men have more addictions, which they are constantly battling and trying to overcome, realising the hold that they have over them. Men that have shared with me some of their addictions have ruined their relationships and other people they love, leaving them with a sense of hopelessness. It leaves me with a feeling of not being alone. Hearing other men's battles has helped me to process what is real for me, and that gambling has the potential to not only ruin my life, but my entire family's life. Do I have it under control? Never. Am I doing everything I can to keep the monsters away? Yes. Am I being open and honest with other men and my wife about gambling? Yes. That's a novel idea for me. For many years, it hid in the darkness where the demons live and no one could ever see it, and I'm slowly bringing it out into the light. Last one is figuring out fatherhood. Growing up, we were always a family. Mum and Dad were so dedicated to us doing things together as a family. We were always such a tight unit. We weren't always a happy family, but there were many, many amazing trips, outings and events together. I was lucky enough to live at Long Bay Regional Park, having a park and a beach as a playground as a boy. As I became a man, I always wanted two kids, ideally a boy and a girl. I always wanted to be a father, and I had an idealistic and sheltered view of how it would be. I'm very blessed to have had a smooth ride with conception. I have had a few close friends who aren't so lucky, and my heart bleeds for them. Chrissy and I were very lucky enough to get pregnant very quickly on both occasions. She's very maternal and always wanted kids too, so we had a honeymoon baby and were parents only 3 years after getting together. A bump in the road came, however, though, when our first child was only 24 weeks in the womb, as Chrissy went to hospital after a routine checkup. I was in Wellington for work at the time and still remember getting the phone call. Come home now, the baby might be coming today. It was a hard plane ride home as I tried to make sense of what was happening. Sienna was born 2 weeks later and spent 100 days in NICU and SCBU. A week after being born, she had a very scary operation, which was one of the scariest hours of my life. I genuinely feared she wouldn't make it through. Brady came along 3 years later, and since then we've been a family of four. There's been some tough times. I've been made redundant from a job twice in that time, putting financial pressure on our family. Chrissy is a wonderful and devoted mother. She always wanted to be as present and available for our kids in their formative years, a decision that I strongly agreed with. However, raising kids under five isn't easy, as I'm sure many of you listening have experienced. Time is taking away, money is tighter, patience is tested, and intimacy wanes. That's certainly my experience anyway. Through the last couple of years, I've started to understand that I wasn't really ready to be a father. I was outside of essentially Men Network at the time, my men's group had finished, and I wanted to have as much time available for Chrissy and Sienna as possible. The 100 days in intensive care for Sienna was highly traumatic for Chrissy. She's changed forever because of it. If I would describe myself through that time, I would use the word numb. I didn't really know what to say, what to do, or how to be. I wanted to come in and see Sienna and Chrissy, but I found it so hard because I hate hospitals, and I found it so hard to see someone I loved so much doing it so tough. In more recent years, I've re-entered the Essentially Men Network and am heavily involved, and I have no doubt that this has a positive effect on my fathering. In the poem, For Brother, What Are We?, there is a quote which I love, being, "We are the sons of our fathers, and we shall follow the print of his foot forever." Sometimes I catch myself doing things that Dad did. There's very rarely a light left on in the house, I can tell you that. The beauty of the Essentially Men Network is that over the weekend itself and in our men's groups, we father each other in a way. Ted has fathered me over the years, and I've gained knowledge and wisdom from him. Others who have shared pain around addictions have fathered me also, showing me a vulnerability to be authentic and real. At a men's group, I can share and be real and am listened to, giving me all the undivided attention that my young boy always yearned for. Make no mistake though, the path ahead of me as a father has been laid out by my dad. He is the one I looked up to the most. He's faced his demons, broke the chain of underfathering, and became a guiding light for me. He tells me he's proud of me and the father that I am. I am proud of him and the father that he is. I know that it's okay to let my kids see me cry. I don't need to be invulnerable and strong the whole time. I can have strong arguments with Chrissy in front of them, but they still know that I love her and them. I hug, kiss, and wrestle with them almost every day, and I love every second of it. It's not perfect, but I've discovered that nothing in life ever is. They test my patience, do silly things, and don't always listen. Chrissy and I have different parenting styles too, and that isn't always easy either, as it creates friction between us, which we need to resolve. What I come back to, though, is gratitude. Gratitude for having a wife who loves me for who I am. Gratitude for having two amazing children who I get to father every day. Gratitude for having two parents who have laid a golden path for me to follow. I consider myself a very, very lucky man. Essentially Men also plays a key role in my life. I can be the real Paul Watson in those environments. I don't need to wear a mask or any armour. It helps me to be a better father, as well as being nurtured and fathered at the same time. It helps me with my sense of self. As Confucius once said, "He who conquers himself is the mightiest warrior." If some of the things I've said resonate today with you, then please consider attending an Essentially Men weekend or encouraging a loved one to attend. I could always use another brother and would welcome one with open arms.
thanks for that deeply personal story, Paul, and the lessons learned along the way. It is now time to extinguish the chalice, so I'll ask Chris Coles to come up and help me again. We have one less candle to extinguish. And we'll put on the screen the words, if you'll join with me to say the words for extinguishing the chalice. We extinguish the flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. My closing words are from an article called Why the Patriarchy is Killing Men by Liz Plank, who, by the way, wrote a very wonderful book called For the Love of Men, A New Vision for Masculinity, which my daughter gave me and insisted that I read. Gender equality isn't just good for women. It also saves men's lives. When I traveled to Iceland in 2018, the World Economic Forum had ranked it number one in gender equality for the entire decade. According to the common way of discussing that honor, the country must be a feminist utopia for women. What goes underreported is how great it is for men, too. In fact, Icelandic men enjoy the highest life expectancy in Europe. They live almost as long as women do. Is there some unique magic in the Reykjavik air that makes this possible? Not at all. Iceland offers a model that could be widely adopted elsewhere in the world. It helps show that changing men's idea about what it means to be a man and lifting up women in the process doesn't make men worse off. It has far-reaching benefits for their lives. The health advantages of feminism for men are not evident only in Iceland. In other countries with stronger gender equality, men also tend to fare better. There is a direct correlation between the state of gender equality in a country and male well-being as measured in factors such as welfare, mental health, fertility, and suicide. Men and women in more gender-equal countries in Europe are less likely to get divorced, be depressed, or die as a result of violence. Women typically live longer than men because of several biological advantages, but that's only part of the equation. The other component of the life expectancy gap is what scientists literally call man-made diseases. These are cultural. Men are more likely to smoke, abuse alcohol, engage in high-risk behavior, and have accidents at work. 80% of drowning victims are male because they're less likely to wear life jackets, more likely to overestimate their swimming abilities, and more likely to take risks. If men's rights activists really want to improve men's lives, then they should join feminists in dismantling bygone ideals of masculinity. Unsurprisingly, the more a man associates with traditional and inflexible ideas about masculinity, the less likely he is to seek counseling. In fact, research has found that men who identified with rigid beliefs that men must provide at any cost, be invulnerable, or be self-sufficient were more likely to have suicidal thoughts and exhibit signs of depression. Idealizing, quote, high traditional masculinity is a risk factor, especially for men who aren't able to fulfill that ideal because of life circumstances such as illness, disability, or the loss of a job. A more flexible understanding of masculinity would not prevent men from becoming unemployed, but it could help them cope with it better. It turns out that when women do well, men do too. Rationally, no man should be afraid of feminism, yet many are. Giving up a small slice of privilege in exchange for a longer and happier life seems a pretty sweet deal to me. But guys, if you don't believe me, just ask Icelandic men. After the postlude, I'll suggest a discussion question. But for now, please sit back and enjoy Frank playing Chopin's Nocturne in C minor. It's now time for discussion. I'm very conscious of the time, which is a little later than usual. But we need some time to get the coffee and tea together. So I'm just going to suggest that maybe you take 10 minutes or so in discussion groups, and Kate will put the question on the board just to start the discussion, and that is, what is your experience of people, yourself or loved ones, being challenged to be authentic, vulnerable, or emotionally connected?